On a special edition of the programme today, we look back at some of the iconic names we featured on the stack this year. From National Geographic to Panini, we've got it all covered today on the stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we look back at some of our favourite interviews with some icons of the print industry. And we start the programme with the editor of perhaps the most iconic title of all time, National Geographic. This year, Editor-in-Chief Susan Goldberg published an editor's letter about an upcoming edition dedicated to race. In the letter, Goldberg admitted that for decades, the magazine's coverage of post-colonial and racial issues had not been handled with the appropriate sensitivity and that they needed to acknowledge it. Let's hear more from Susan now.
Decided about a year and a half ago that we would do a special issue devoted to the subject of race. And we decided to do that for a few reasons. First, it seems like race is at the center, unfortunately, of so many of the conversations going on in the United States and around the world. And mostly, it's the ways that race is used to divide us. It does just seem like this is what everybody is talking about, almost no matter what other topics, race topics, get involved in those conversations. So that seemed like one reason we should do this issue. The other was that April 4th of this year marks the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., you know, the most important civil rights leader ever in the United States, I think it's fair to say. And it seemed like a good time to step back and take stock, really, of where are we on race? How far have we come to the goals that Dr. King promulgated and pushed so hard for? So those were the reasons that we decided to do the issue. And the issue really is just kicking off an entire year of coverage around race and diversity. We'll also have stories coming up about Muslims and Latinos, Asian Americans, Native Americans. And our story also starts with a scientific and sort of evolutionary and biological look at what race is and what race isn't.
And Susan, at the same time, you looked back at the magazine's history, you know, very proud history, but at the same time, you noticed that there's been some problem with the past coverage. You know, sometimes you even said it was almost a bit racist, the coverage as well. So are you trying to look into that as well, some sort of, even in an apologetic way?
Well, I thought that if we were going to do a story about race, that we also needed to look at the history of how National Geographic has covered race. And that's because I have heard from so many readers in my job that National Geographic was the first time they'd ever really noticed people or communities or things outside of their own lives, right? We took people around the world. And so, you know, the authenticity of that storytelling is very important. And when we cover issues like race that are so fraught, being credible is even more important than that. I thought that to be credible in our coverage of race, before we started looking at everybody else, maybe we needed to look a little bit at ourselves. And so I asked a historian from the University of Virginia, John Edwin Mason, to help us look into our archives and tell us our own story.
And which type of stories did you deem they were a bit problematic and that perhaps, you know, since you've been editor or of course, you know, since the 70s, it's been changing?
Yes, I mean, the good news here is that, you know, since the 1970s, our coverage has changed a lot. But when you look before the 1970s, you see a publication really reflecting the views of an elite white majority. You see a publication that began actually at the height of colonialism, and it reflects the views of the colonizers and the colonized, and you do see how that plays out on the pages. You know, you see some language that certainly we would never use today, but mostly I think you just get a view of the world just through an elite white lens rather than, you know, a view that was more inclusive of the voices of the people who were being covered. Now, Happily, I would say that has changed completely in the years, certainly since the civil rights movement, where, you know, of course we are including the voices of the people who we're covering, and increasingly we're making sure that the people telling those stories are people who really understand the communities that they're covering.
Well, talking about that, you even mentioned in your editor letters a story about Haiti that I believe you've done in 2015. Would you mind telling us a bit more about that story?
Sure. In 2015, we decided to go to Haiti, which we have been to many times. This time, though, we decided to do it a little bit differently. And we put cameras in the hands of a group of young Haitian photographers we were working with, and we asked them to document life in Haiti, because they're going to see and be able to document their own lives in a way that outside photographers probably wouldn't. Now, happily, the photographer we had on this assignment has been to Haiti many, many times and has done an incredible job and loves Haiti and has spent a great deal of time there. But I thought it was an important element also to see the documentation of the young Haitian photographers too, taking us into their own lives in a way that, you know, none of us really would have access to otherwise. I'm very proud of that. I mean, one thing that I hope doesn't get lost in this conversation is that National Geographic has a really proud history in many ways. I mean, we sent explorers and scientists and researchers and writers and photographers all over the world and really brought the world home to people in a way they had never seen it before. And that is a part of our past that we're very proud of and that continues to, you know, set a high bar for us today. But, you know, I did think it was important on the topic of race in particular to look at where had we done it well, but also where had we not done as well as we should have.
And Susan, the race issue, you know, the April 2018, will it be, you know, in collaboration with the other National Geographic titles around the world, or is this mainly for the U.S. edition?
Well, we do publish in 33 languages, and the way it works is that our editors in those other countries can decide what they want to put on their own covers and what content they decide to use. They also produce some of their own content. So what I'm hoping, and I haven't seen what everybody's doing yet, is that, you know, a lot of people will run the stories about the science of race, because those are really global stories. We've also got a story about humankind's propensity since the dawn of time to look at people who aren't like us and label them as the other. And why is that? So there are at least two very global stories in this issue. The other stories are more United States focused, but I'm certainly hoping that our overseas editions will use at least a few of the stories about race and then perhaps even produce some of their own content.
And Susan, we're here a show that values print media, The Stack. I'm always been a fan of National Geographic. In terms of the print products, you know, the magazine, do you still see people like valuing the print and going buying their monthly edition?
Oh, absolutely. We have, you know, about 54 million readers of our print issue around the world. And so I don't think it's not going anywhere anytime
soon.
But I hear from people all the time how much they love holding the magazine, touching the magazine, collecting the magazine, saving the magazine. They have walls full of yellow-spined magazines. So I do. I hear from people all the time about that. But, you know, that said, it is probably ultimately a digital future. But I think that, you know, what I really love is the combination of the immediacy of digital storytelling that we can do, and the way we can bring maps and graphics and photos to life on digital platforms, but then also have the beautiful, eternal wonder of holding a magazine in your hands.
In 2018 was the year that Russia hosted the Football World Cup finals. And with every World Cup comes, of course, a Panini World Cup sticker album. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, who I believe managed, or has managed by now, to complete his album, went to the Panini offices here in the UK to talk about the iconic legacy of the sticker album. He spoke to Nick Clark, Special Projects Editor at Panini, and Jessica Bell, Senior Marketing Executive from Panini.
Nostalgia is so, so important to us as a company, but I think to the individual. I think when you rip open a sticker packet as an older guy, I'm in my 40s now, it takes me back to that time in 1986 when I was first swapping, collecting stickers with my friends in the playground. When you rip open a packet, you smell the glue on the stickers, you see that shiny that you want, and it just brings back a really pleasurable experience, especially for me. And we're finding that as well with a second generation of collectors who are also going back to a time that they loved. Now, these guys, you remember, that you know they're collecting them, but they also want to share that experience with their own children. And that's a really important part of collecting, is taking you back to that time.
Jessica, I have a question for you. I think a lot of people are interested to know a bit more about the history of Panini. When did it start and when did it become big as well?
So Panini was founded in 1961 with the launch of our first Calciatori football players collection. The founders, the Panini family, were brothers Giuseppe, Benito, Franco and Umberto, and their mother Olga. They'd already opened a new stand in Modena in 1945, and by 1954 had started the Panini Brothers newspapers distribution office, and it really grew from there. It wasn't until 1978 that Panini UK came into force with our Football 78 collection.
And there's some interesting facts about the machine where you print the stickers as well. What's the name again, Nick?
Well, I just mentioned Umberto Panini. So Umberto actually invented the Fifi-matic machine, which is an automatic packaging machine. So it packages all their stickers. Now, that machine's still being used today. It's been modified slightly to bring it in line with the volume of stickers that are going through the system, but it's still that original machine. And I think that's fascinating. We're still using the authentic machinery from back in the day.
And Jessica, I would like to ask you, because I know you work with marketing for Panini. I mean, this album, let's be honest, is not only for kids, right? Because as I was talking to Nick, because there is this nostalgic power. So when you work with marketing, you basically have to reach like a child, but also adults that have been collecting for quite a few World Cups, may I say.
Yes, we have quite a big cohort of second generation collectors, your dads and your lads. You know, we've got families collecting, and when we're sort of drawing up our marketing plans, we really tend to target those second generation collectors on social media. That's become the new swapping playground for adults. I think that's been a really key development for us over the last, I'd say, two World Cups. So perhaps 2010, we launched Twitter just after then, and we really saw that kind of second generation collector come to the fore on Twitter, and I'd say the 2014 World Cup. I think what's important when we talk about nostalgia and, you know, this digital age that we live in, is how interesting it is and how powerful those sticker collections still are in their original form. They've really transcended that movement towards digital, and they've stayed true to what they are. We obviously have got the Panini Collectors app, which is free to download, and people can collect their online album as well. But really, that sits as a complementary product to the print edition of the World Cup album.
You were telling me there's two places where there are Panini factories, in a way, where the stickers are produced. Can you go through that?
Our head office is in Modena in Italy, and that is where our stickers are packaged, sorted and sent out. That's a really large production facility. We also have a factory that sits in Brazil, and that's a mirror image of the factory in Modena. They doubled their capacity in 2014 just to meet the demand for the South American market. So that's a really big factory for us as well. Our stickers are printed in Italy, and then they're distributed from our factory in Modena and likewise in Brazil.
And Nick, I have a technical question to you as well. How many stickers can you produce, actually?
Okay, so we can produce over 25 million packets of stickers a day, which is a phenomenal amount, which equates to over 750 million individual stickers a week.
A question for you, Jessica. What are your biggest markets?
I would say for World Cup, the biggest market is Brazil. We sell the World Cup stickers in over 100 countries worldwide. So wherever football is strong, you'll find Panini. This will be our 13th World Cup collection. We started in 1970, so we've got 48 years of association, and we reach over 1 million sales outlets worldwide. So it really is a global phenomenon. And as Nick said, we tend to see the World Cup sticker album as what kicks off the excitement for the tournament.
And guys, actually, in fact, I have my very own album that I brought it here. And, you know, as you can see, I'm doing pretty well. But for example, Brazil, there's one sticker missing. And your guy's not giving to me.
Look, I could give you that sticker now, but I don't think you should have it. I think that would take away the pleasure of finding that sticker you need. I mean, I could. Would you want it?
I can see if I've got that in my list, in my sort of stack of swaps for you. But yeah. I feel like you've got to earn that one sticker, haven't you? Otherwise, you know, it loses its value somewhat.
That's the pleasure of swapping, isn't it? I mean, you need your final Brazil sticker, don't you? Now, what would you give someone for that sticker? If they have that sticker, you'd probably... I don't know how many shinies.
I think I might wait and swap with someone, because I mean that's again the communal thing of having a World Cup sticker, and it's funny, we've been mentioned there's even some little political scandals where I think in Brazil there are two politicians that were playing around with stickers. You know, I mean they shouldn't be doing that, but you know it's kind of addictive in a way, right?
I think it's the pleasure of swapping. It brings people together. It continues the conversation of football. You know, you're seeing all these guys lined up together, rearing up for the tournament, and I think it's an exciting thing to be part of, really.
We always get a lot of requests from football commentators for complete collections and albums and packets, because they tend to use that as their guide to the tournament, and they like learning all the players' names and their faces so they can recognise them when the tournament comes around. And I think that really speaks volumes of how well liked the collection is and how recognisable it is, and people are using that as their official guide, as it were. So we like to say that, don't we?
With this collection, as your collection, it is your collection, isn't it? That's what becomes your own, and it becomes something that belongs to you. And that's the same for when you open up your sticker packets. That's your sticker that you own and you put into your album. And this is something that you'll probably keep for a long, long time and pass on to other generations. So it's a very special thing that you're producing here.
Is it true? Do you print more or less the same number of the stickers for the players, or is there one that is a bit more rare than the other?
No, you're correct in saying it's an urban myth. So all stickers are printed in an equal quantity and they're mixed at the factory. So there is a myth. Stickers become rare basically because people hold on to their favourite stickers, whether it be a favourite player or a shiny. They may put them in their exercise book. I think it was in 1990, Paul Gascoigne became a rare sticker because he was very popular at the time. So yes, it's a myth, and all stickers are printed in an equal volume.
Finally on this week's programme, the Queen of City magazines, Time Out. This icon of print celebrated 50 years in 2018. It was founded in London by Tony Elliott and became the foundation of, well, what a city magazine is. I spoke to Tony and to Giulio Bruno, CEO of the Time Out Group, to talk about the half century of Time Out.
When I started, it was a response, I suppose, to all the really interesting things that were going on, particularly from the kind of alternative independent sector, counterculture it was referred to then, and the information was hard to find. And I wanted to know about it, so I basically ended up doing a magazine for myself. And I think that we got good response from sales eventually, you know, fairly quickly, so that by the time you got into... We were every 3 weeks from, you know, August 1968. So when you got into the middle of 1969... You knew that the audience was there and very, very kind of dedicated, etc. So, I mean, I had a sort of confidence that... I certainly had a confidence that it would go on and on and on and on. Had no idea what size or ultimately what place we would end up where we are.
The fearlessness of youth, I guess, plays its role with these things. So what, were you 21
21
years old?
Yeah. Yeah,
extraordinary. See, these entrepreneurial types are amazing, aren't they, Julio?
Fearless. He's still fearless. Hasn't changed.
Yeah. And Julio, just tell us and tell our audience your association with Time Out. How far back does that go? And tell us what it's been like coming into something that obviously was, you know, it's a pretty iconic kind of brand, I guess. Tell us a bit about your association personally.
Well, it is an iconic brand, and that's why I joined in at the end of 2015 as executive chairman. Then becoming the group CEO in 16 when I took the company public in the London Stock Exchange, AIM. I joined Time Out because I knew Time Out. All my business in my life, I've been traveling around the world nonstop for work. And I used to pick up Time Out in places from Tokyo to Rio de Janeiro, whatever, all over the world. When I lived in London first in the 90s, I would be using Time Out. Because I was still, even though with the internet was beginning kind of thing, being more commercial, but still you needed to have that, what I call now a helping hand of what to do in a city where you can do 400 million things. And we didn't have FOMO on those days, right? But I think I did, like a lot of other people. I mean, I don't want to miss out on the good things. And Time Out was that inspiration and that information.
We didn't have the acronym, but I think we had the emotion.
horrible acronym.
I know, sorry, Tony.
It's good. It's like portmanteau words. You love them or hate them. Mainly we hate them. Tony, let me ask you about, I guess, a trend which has informed Time Out throughout its life, really. Yeah. and certainly as it got bigger and bigger. And that's, I guess it's almost a paradoxical thing, which is that the bigger you get, the more international the reach, certainly the international the ambition, the more you need to sort of almost restate your very local credentials. Has that been a balancing act? Because I guess people find it maybe harder to believe that a global brand can know the secrets just around the corner. And as you've already described, that was very much the kind of the selling point. It was countercultural. It was hyper-local. Has that been a balancing act?
No, I don't think so. Because if you see Time Out today, ultimately as a great big worldwide database, it's been built up by a series of local databases. So almost everything we've ever done has had people and contributors in a particular city. And we've kept to cities largely, I mean, that's partly, some of that came a bit from me because I always thought it was more interesting to do a city in detail and really up to date and contemporary than to do some kind of, travel guide to France or, France or Spain or whatever. So it's very, very much city based and it's modular, so it's very, very flexible kind of structure.
And let's reflect a little bit on that. And you already actually alluded to this when the remarks you've made already about the evolution of digital platforms and how they've reshaped the space or recalibrated it, I suppose. It's an inevitable question, but what's your view on how Time Out has stewarded its way through that challenge? It's now a multi-platform brand entity. Print isn't even the biggest component anymore, as it was for such a long time. Presumably that's been challenging. Do you remain very confident about the robust business models that you have in place or that you're instigating or you have been instigating in the last few years to see that, another 50 years?
Well, in another 500 years. It's not easy in this world of media, and now we are in media and entertainment. Still is not a robust model, right? Mm. But we are on our way to be that. And I like to say that we are more platform agnostic, saying a fancy word, because we create this content that we have been creating for 50 years since Tony started this. And we keep creating that content in the same way. Now, because the world has changed, we put that content in many places. We put it in print. We still believe in print. We put it in digital. We put it in the app. And we even put it in our events, or in our own Time Out Market, which where we serve food, if you want, and that food is also content. So in that world, that hasn't, we have evolved, but the principal idea of inspiration and information is still there, now in many more cities. And so I see this as a necessity today, because in the world of overwhelming information and misinformation, you still need that true ambassador of the city, that helping hand that says, you could do a lot of things here, but we believe, from a professional standpoint, that these are the best things to do, the coolest things, the most interesting things to do in those cities that we cover.
And I just wonder on that point, is the deck, for a long time, the deck's been, I feel, almost stacked against brands or companies or concerns that are trying to do what Time Out does by the big search engines. We know they wield the power and they can leverage their control almost of search, if you like, to kind of push people around a little bit. How do you react to that? How do you have to, because it's inevitable, you must work with these big companies, but at the same time, you need to defend your revenue streams, which they're less sherry about. How do you strike that balance? And is that, presumably, again, that's one of the top challenges that you and Time Out faces?
Well, of course, it's a challenge because they are competitors and collaborators at the same time, right? Or co-competitors. It's not easy because they have the kind of resources that we cannot even dream of. Mm. It's impossible. I mean, that's done. The ship has sailed a long time ago with the likes of Google and others. What I like to say, and Tony and I discuss this quite often, is that we have to be true to ourselves, true to who we are. And we represent the city from the point of view of professionals that do this every day, rather than any super blogger, any influencer, any 14-year-old writing about this is my favorite dish. And all respect to that, because in the world today, everybody is having opinions, alternative facts. Truth is not truth anymore. We are true to who we are. And that content, that we like to say that content is still king, is very important. And then, of course, our tone of voice, how we present the information, how we talk about it. And then when you talk in print, how do we design, how we present the brand. And there is a power of Time Out that is ubiquitous, that is also consistency in what you present. And people resonate with that. I mean, we have 270 million monthly global reach. that's not compared to 2 billion of Facebook, and we cannot and don't want to compete on that. But it's still sizable and growing.
I mean, also, I think if you use what I'm just going to say, any search engine, i.e. Google, and put in, you know, what are the best restaurants in, you know, Amsterdam or whatever, it doesn't matter what city, their system's not really capable of telling you what is genuinely the best. Whereas one of the things I think we have achieved now is that we are a recognised source of information that people who want to know the best would come to us, you know. So I think the search engines generally work good for us in the way that people can get information, but then they realise that the information is of only of a certain kind of depth, and then people gradually can create a relationship with us, and they're complementary in a way, you know.
And that's interesting, because that's, I suppose, about authority, authenticity, which are kind of often used rather glibly, but that really matters if you're talking about a trusted voice. Mm-hmm. Just to pick up, though, Tony, with you, on something that sort of Julio alluded to there, which is this idea of the supposedly democratizing power of digital. You know, isn't it great? Everyone's a journalist now. There's no barriers to entry. I wonder if that is such a good thing. I learned my trade, if I've learned anything, on newspapers, you know, the editor's fearsome red pen, and you learned how to do things properly. I know, well, you know, Monocle's editor here, your paths have crossed back in the Time Out days, of course, a man who knows how to wield the red pen. Yeah. Do you still worry about that fact, that there's not the same kind of rigour about training people how to tell a good story, how to be an authentic voice? You know, sometimes the old ways of doing things were a bit better, maybe.
I think in Time Out's case, one of the things that's amazed me in the last 10, 15 years is how all the people who work on the brand, basically in any form, but particularly editorial, I always used to worry about new people kind of getting what the DNA was and all the rest of it. And now it all happens almost automatically, which is fantastic. So I think that we retain our quality by virtue of what we do, but also because we're prepared to really make sure that we've got people on the ground in any place to write about things. And it goes more than that. You know, they all have expertise. You know, so in the old days when we used to printed guides, we used to run them like magazines with somebody who is in charge of the nightlife section, and somebody in terms of art, and there's somebody in terms of eating and drinking and so on. All those principles have still evolved. Mm. As Julia would say, it is hard to keep everything going at the same thing, because the where the money comes from, all the rest of it changes. But the strength of what we do does cut through.
That's all for this week's programme, a special edition of The Stack, looking back at some of the iconic names we've met over the past 12 months. Thanks to our hard-working producer, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our equally hard-working editor, Cassie Galpin. Comments or queries or suggestions for the year ahead are welcome. Get in touch with Fernando on fp@monocle.com. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.